And actually the whole thing really, I went from working, you know, 15-hour days, as I described before, with to working 15-hour days on battle systems, because it's just what the company needed. And the thing is, and it's always the way with a business, is the fact that no matter how much you love your business, you've got two aspects. You've got the reason for the business, the creativity, the fun, the ethics, everything behind the business, and the reason you're there, the passion. And then you've got what I call the piece of paper.
As I do these Insider Insight episodes and talk to different creators and designers, it never ceases to amaze me some of the paths that led them to where they are now. And that's going to be true of today's. I sit down with Colin Young of Battle Systems. We talk about what the battle systems are, and if you've watched any of my live stream games, you know that I use their terrain. We talk about the process of creating terrain that doesn't look like it's made of cardboard. And we spent a good bit of time talking about Core Space. That is the game that he created, and you're going to love that game's origin story. All right, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy my time with Colin.
Third Floor Wars delivers interviews, insights, and discussions about everything hitting the tabletop. Rulebooks, plastic models, dice, and cards in hand. Let the gaming begin. Tabletop games let you escape and unleash grand battles and regale epic tales of adventure with your friends. If you love gaming and learning from players, designers, experts, and creators, you are in the right place. Pull up a chair. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Podcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're talking to Colin Young of Battle Systems. Now, if you watched our live stream battle report between me when I was playing the Arcanist Karras and my good friend Jim playing Seamus, you actually saw some of Colin's terrain in action. We used it to build the board for that live stream. Colin and Battle Systems also have released a new miniatures game called Core Space. So we're going to talk about all of that. First off, though, Colin, welcome to the Third Floor.
Hey, Craig. Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. So traditionally, what I like to know from my first-time guests is how you found tabletop gaming. So how did you find the hobby? Do you remember kind of your first exposure to it?
Yes, I do. I was 13 years old and in school, and a friend of mine gave me a book. It was the original Rogue Trader. And
he's just showing your age, Colin.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, man, 47 then. And I kind of like looked at this book, and I was kind of like, I just looked at it. It had a picture of, you know, some sci-fi stuff on the front. And I was like, right, this is cool. You know, I'm not a great reader, you know. And he said, no, open it up and have a look. So I started flicking it through, and that was it. The whole world around me just disappeared, you know, because it was like someone had read my mind about what I love about. When I was like really young, I'm going to go right back now. But when I was really young, I must have been 4 or 5. My mum was obviously really stressed, and she was dragging me through the town on an island where I grew up, and she was just dragging me, and she dragged me into a lamppost, and I sort of right into the lamppost. Had this big bump on my head. I was crying, you know. And she obviously felt really guilty, and we didn't really have much money, but she must have felt really guilty because she took us into a shop called Woolworths, which is no longer around anymore. And she said, just pick something. And I was really into 1960s Batman.
No kidding.
And I had the little Batmobiles with the two little Batman and Robins in it. And I said, I'll have that. Not expecting to get it. She got it for me. And I got home, and I just started playing with this, and I built myself like their little bat cave thing out of Lego and things that I had. And I was just like, wow, this world is massive. You know, because normally people are playing with these big sort of like 6-inch figures. And I was into 3 3/4 Star Wars as well and all that kind of stuff. And some people have big 12-inch like Action Men and stuff like that. And I was really frustrated about the fact that when you play with these, you don't get much, you know, if you want a vehicle, you've got to go big, you know. So. Yeah. Whereas this, I was like, wow, I can use these cars. And I started building up this entire world very quickly around this one little Batmobile. So then I got a butter knife. That's the one I was allowed to touch as a kid, you were out cutting. And I prized the little figures out of the seat so I could actually take them out and play with them. And actually, I think once I got those figures out and I started building the worlds around it, I kind of got hooked on the immersion of I can have an entire, almost like a city on a tabletop, as right. opposed to if I've got, you know, Star Wars, I might get a ship on the right. tabletop. And I think that's what did it. And I used to, from that point on, I used to have a lot of toys that were based around that, things like Zoids and stuff like that, where I could really get into it. And then Rogue Trader was handed to me, and it was just like someone out there had read my mind and started a company that was just
had literally, you saw your whole childhood right there. Right?
I did, but done properly. Do you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I was like really kind of, I was just absolutely struck, and that was it. All my pocket money, everything, went out and got myself a job just so I could buy the miniature figures, and just spent a fortune on the stuff.
That's fantastic. So I'd be curious then, Colin, so you get into it. Now, did you actually enjoy playing the tabletop games as well, or were you strictly more into the hobby aspect?
Okay, so for me, it was about play. Obviously, when I was really young, I was literally playing. So I was like, right. Sound effects, the whole thing, really, really enjoyed myself. I think what happened was when you get to about 13, you're not allowed to play anymore. I remember my mum saying to me on my 13th birthday, actually, right, this is the last year you're going to get toys, And then I was gutted. I was like, what, because I still play with toys now, So I was kind of like, this gave me an excuse to still play with stuff that I love, but in a more kind of grown up acceptable way, because sure. I was rolling dice. It was a game. We were allowed to play board games. And of course, I enjoyed it because it gave a function. Then it became a win lose situation. Whereas when you're a kid and you're playing, you just make it up as you go along. This gave right. me a scenario. It gave me rules to follow. It gave me direction and focus. And I think, I guess I never played again, really, other than tabletop games. But I really enjoyed it. I tended to mod the games a lot. I didn't like the mass war games. So when I played Warhammer 40K, I would like boil it down to maybe 5 to 10 miniatures, and I'd boost up there, give them a few more rules because there's less yep. of them, and I made the skirmish version of it before it was around, and that's how I used to play all of my games that I ever bought.
Yeah, you're way ahead of the skirmish craze then. That's good.
I just didn't like this whole wave of infantry walking in and being wiped out, because you spend a lot of time painting the miniatures and building the terrain and doing all this lovely stuff, and they all get wiped out with a dice roll. And I kind of felt sorry for them or something. I don't know. So I thought I wanted the more heroic kind of individual, I guess at the time, the kind of role-playing Dungeons and Dragons kind of feel. But right. I didn't know what that was back then, but I kind of made that up.
So, Colin, so you get, young adolescent into high school, you're playing the games, and then at some point you get, of age for university. That's usually when we hear in these stories people taking a break from the geek hobbies. Did you ever take a break and then come back to it, or was this a constant in your life?
I'd say it was a constant, but I definitely reduced my activity. So, I would go from kind of, you get a job and you do all of that kind of stuff. Life takes over. I would say from about 16, around about 14, 15, I got into training and doing all the kind of fitness things and had all these separate hobbies that I was trying to get into. But I was always kind of like, I paint at the weekend or something. So I kind of reduced to kind of a painter with the intention of gaming. And every now and again, something would catch my eye and I'd spend a little bit of cash and then, open the box, give it a good smell, that nice that nice board game, new board game smell. And then generally I would just kind of like maybe get a game in or something. But most of my friends at that point were really not into tabletop gaming at all. And of course, we're going back, there's no internet or anything, so
sure,
again, showing me age, but there's no internet and no real, so there's no community thing, there was no mobile phones, so I was really just left to kind of enjoy it as I was, just me and a scalpel and some paints and whatever figures I could grab hold of.
Now, before battle systems existed or the idea of owning or starting up battle systems started, what did you do career-wise?
I dabbled in quite a lot of stuff, really. Had I was teaching martial arts at one point, and I wanted to get into teaching guitar as well, but that's kind of a bit competitive where I am. And ultimately, whilst doing that, I've got all my, you know, my usual day jobs. So I did various kind of retail jobs, and I ended up becoming like a facilities manager of a big kind of storage plant. And I know it's kind of new in the UK at that point, but storage was big in the USA, you know, storage centers where you get your own locker and stuff. So I kind of worked my way up through there for 8 or 9 years until I become training manager for developing the sales in the company. And then I really got into like sales training and nonverbal behaviors and the psychology of sales and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And of course, running the big facilities as well, I had all the business background. And I just, after about, 18, 19, nearly 20 years, I just got fed up of, making money for other people and not getting a chance to actually do the things that I really, really love. So, I kind of, about 3 years before I left the company, I started Battle Systems, and I kind of had the two jobs at the same time until Battle Systems was self-supporting. And then I was like, right, see you later.
So out of curiosity, where does the initial idea for Battle Systems come from? So when does it become something like, you know, I think I want to sell something, I think I want to make something? What does that look like the day you start thinking it?
I think probably around about my, I would have thought mid to late 30s, I was kind of realizing that I wanted to do more of the stuff that made me happy. So I just started the gaming stuff. I started spending the cash and painting again. And the issue that I had and always had with miniature games is the fact that I found the scenery very frustrating. That you, unlike today, you go into GW or something like that, there's scenery, it's expensive, but you can kit a table out. That wasn't around, so you had to build all your own stuff. Most people, if they wanted a battlefield, they'd put a couple of books under a green sheet and that would be the hill. That's how I started. But for me, you spend so much time painting the miniatures, and the miniatures are beautiful and everything, and then you put them on this really kind of poor excuse for a battlefield or a scenery. So I, you know, even before that, whenever I did game, I started just building my own scenery just out of cardboard. First of all, some scratch built stuff, a bit of spray, a bit of dry brushing, just something quick and simple. But I kind of got fed up with the fact that once you've built that, you play it a few times, it becomes a bit boring. You're always storming the same base or doing something like that. Or, I started making, in fact, I had an old copy of Space Crusade. And I just took I just took the board from it and I just cut it up and then cut doorways into it. And even though it was a floor, I was using it for walls. And then I would kind of clip the walls together so that every time I played, I could have a different kind of, you know, base or a different mission to go through, something different. And I started adding multi-levels and just doing that for myself. And I found it was much more fulfilling for the games and stuff. And after that, I was like, well, you know, technology got a bit better. I got a graphics tablet and I was like, well, I'm going to draw some walls, then print it out. And then I'm going to, so it actually looks like walls. And then I started doing that. And I think I shared some stuff on Facebook and people were like, oh my God, wow, this is amazing. Where can I buy that? And I was like, well, you can't, it's mine. It's like, well, you make me one. And I was like, no, it takes me forever, you know. you couldn't pay me enough to sit there making stuff like this for a month, you know. So, but there was clearly a need for it. And that's where Battle Systems come from. It was really, I went to print and play. That's how it started.
So if I were to go back and look at what you posted up on Facebook, Colin, and see from a design perspective, both in how you connected everything as well as the quality of the graphics, and look at what you have now. So for those listening that aren't familiar with Battle Systems, I came across Colin's work on the second to last Kickstarter you guys did, for the fantasy terrain. I had seen similar ideas before and passed on it. And the biggest thing that made me pass on it is it looks like what it is. It looks like cardboard terrain, right? And it feels like cardboard terrain, and you look at it, you go, yeah, that's cardboard. I watched, I don't know, the first 30 seconds of your video before I realized what it was in the Kickstarter. And that's when it hooked me. I'm like, holy cow, this gives me the benefit of that type of terrain without it looking like a bunch of cheap terrain. And I got the Kickstarter stuff in, Colin, and it kind of knocked my socks off. I'm not going to lie to you. It's gorgeous. Gorgeous enough that I've featured it in my live stream games. It's beautiful work. And there's a lot of innovations in how you connect things and how those become hidden once they're connected. And I'm trying to give background to the people listening, because what I want to know, Colin, is what I got in the Kickstarter. What changed from that to your initial prototypes that you did on Facebook?
Okay, so yeah, so original prototypes on Facebook would have been the print and play stuff. So I was, first of all, I'm heavily into sci-fi, so I started making these sci-fi walls. Now, the difference is that I would do all the artwork on there and create these A4 letterhead American size. Yep. You would then buy those from me and for like 15, 16 quid. And then you can print as many as you want and you can just build a whole battle system. You can fill your table, you can fill 10 tables. And it looked really nice. It was single level, looked really, really nice. And I was using it to play on anyway. I made it for myself originally. Anyway.
Sure.
That was, everybody loved it, but the time invested in order to actually build that is going to be the big issue. So what happened is that, I mean, you know, you're looking at a, yeah, if you were dedicated and didn't have a day job, it'd take you a month to kind of just sit there crafting it, you know. And I'm like a scalpel man, you know, so I'm like, I'm really, really, you know, I'm all about the scalpel. There's a certain motor functions to using a scalpel. Sounds really, yeah, really daft, but there's a skill to doing it. And of course, some people are going to struggle with that. So there is a skill kind of barrier to get over. And I think after the first year, that's how I did it. I thought, well, I'll just do this. I didn't really plan on making it a big career. It was more a case of sharing what I love and just maybe making a bit of money on the side, you know, some sort of fulfillment, you know, make me feel about. And by the time it was getting close to the end of the first year, I was just like, you know what? I wonder if. And I was kind of working on a second set for that. But at the same time, I had this idea of like, how much would it cost to get it manufactured? So if I made it flat and I did it like this and I made these little cardboard clips and you know, and I'd spent a good couple of years prior to that just learning things like Photoshop and, you know, so I've always been an artist and, you know, as it were, but I had to start learning how to use artwork on computers, so Photoshop and all that kind of stuff, and I slowly kind of put it together. Excuse me. And I think what happened was I built a prototype and I took it to our first show. I spent a little bit of cash and we went to a show. I put like a little 6-foot table and people were coming around going, this is amazing, we're going to buy it. And I was like, you can't, yeah. But I'm thinking if I can manufacture it so that you guys don't have to actually spend any time at all. And it's already pre-colored, pre-cut, you know, just ready to game straight from the box, basically. A guy come up to me. Two people come up to me and mentioned Kickstarter. One was Mantic Games, you mm-hmm. might be familiar with, and yeah, the other
they're
one
they're familiar with Kickstarter. That's for sure.
They are, yeah. And they mentioned to me about Kickstarter, and also a really good friend of mine, Chris Birch from the Defius.
Nice.
Yeah. And he came out. I didn't know him at the time, and he basically said, "Wow, this is amazing. Absolutely love this. You should put it on Kickstarter." And I was like, "Right, okay." So, and he said, "It was really nice to me." He said to me, I think this should go on Kickstarter. However, you know, people make a lot of mistakes on Kickstarter. So please do, you know, hook up with me. We'll have a Skype call and I'll just give you the rundown on the do's and like the 101, you know, of Kickstarter, what you do, you need to know. And I think he spent a good 2.5-3 hours helping me out.
That's
and
awesome.
Actually, still to this day, I speak to people and who say about Kickstarter and I'm like, I tried to pay it forward and say, look, I'll give you some of my time and I'll tell you what I've been told about shipping and how to treat your supporters and everything else, communication, the whole thing that often goes wrong on a Kickstarter. And that's, we went to Kickstarter and obviously it was very successful and that was it. At that point, I was like, right, I can make this. This seems like a business that would support myself and my family. And it's something I enjoy doing, and it's kind of where the print and play should have been in the first place.
Right.
So, and that was it. And then from that point onwards, it's just, yeah, artwork has got better as I've learned. I guess I've become a better artist, but it's not just about being able to draw. It's about being able to do the art. It's about knowing what looks right at the right scale and how to kind of to fool the eye into believing something is what it is. You mentioned it doesn't look like cardboard.
Exactly. That's the key.
It is. And like when we do, I mean, maybe not so many at the moment with COVID, but we're normally doing sort of two or three really big shows a year. And the amount of people that come up and, you know, saying, oh, this is amazing, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then you lift it up and they're looking at it and they're just like, and they're standing right there. You talk to them for 10 minutes and they're like, wait, is this cardboard? It's like, yeah, it's cardboard. It's like, wow, it's really light. It's like you can flat pack it away and just take it. It all fits in this box over here. And they're just like, oh my God. And then at that point, they're amazed by how it looks. But once they realize how practical it is and that they don't have to paint it, they don't have to cut it, they don't have to do nothing, they just have to sort of clip it together. And you know what? You don't have to build that. You can build this over here instead of the same thing. They're just, and I think that's where people are like, wow. And then they love it. And then you lift the roof off and go, oh, and you can game inside as well. You can take your figures inside. You can open this door and look at this cargo crate. This opens, you can lift it off. Look, there's stuff inside, you know, and it's kind of like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And so, and that's normally where the hook is. And that's what I always missed gaming when I was younger, is that ability, lovely miniatures, inferior terrain. And so everything I build for me, you know, it's what I want to do. It's not necessary, not always necessarily the right business choice. Although it always works out to be that way, but
that's not the driver.
That's not the driver for me. The driver is I want this, you know. And I was Mr. Sci-Fi, and I was like, right, fantasy. I really want fantasy terrain. And I knew about some future projects that I wanted to do, and I was like, right, let's just put the terrain together for it in advance, you know. So that's kind of how it developed from that first Kickstarter all the way through the multiple Kickstarters that we've done.
So I'd be curious, and I'm going to use one of the pieces that I love of yours as an example to walk through this. And it's the pitched roof dock house that I got as part of my Kickstarter, right? It's a beautiful piece that's got the slanted roofs, and it's got the dock that's got the decking around it and stuff like that.
Let's go. The lake tower, the lake house, is it?
The lake house. Thank you.
Yes.
It's a beautiful piece. But what I want to do is go back to, what's the first step in designing the lake house? So I assume you get an idea, like I want to make a house with, you know, decking around it. What's the next step? How do you go from idea to prototype to finished product? Can you walk me through that?
I can. It's not the same way that most people do it.
Okay.
So what happens is basically is the lake house kind of already exists because I decided I wanted a townhouse. So, you know, and a tavern and so on and so forth. So what happens is that the first building I made of the fantasy terrain was a townhouse, a very simple two level kind of, you know, Victorian-esque fantasy kind of feel with a nice slanty roof. And the first thing is when you work in cardboard, what you have to do is you have to make a decision about what is achievable. And right. What isn't. So I can make anything in cardboard. It doesn't matter what it is. So if you say to me, I want a tree, I can absolutely make it in cardboard. But the thing is that certain things you don't want to do in cardboard, because if I build a townhouse and I stick it there and it's cardboard, until you get out really close, you don't realize it's cardboard. And so it looks great. And it will continue to look great until I put a tree next to it that's made of cardboard. And then that will look nice, but you'll know it's cardboard immediately. And when you see that tree as cardboard, everything else becomes cardboard.
Interesting.
So you've got to be very careful that you don't, you know, so in sci-fi on some Kickstarters, we get a lot of, you know, oh, I need a sentry gun. We really want a sentry gun. You could do that out of cardboard. I was like, yeah, I could, but we won't, because then you've got this cardboard sentry gun and everything else looks like cardboard around it. Take the gun away and everything else looks like, you know, much more realistic immediately. So for the lake house, or the townhouse is how the lake house started. I literally just think, right, I want this townhouse and it needs to be reasonably modular. So some of our terrain sets are completely modular. It means you flat pack them, you can build it, do anything with it. With something like the fantasy terrain, the buildings are a little bit more bespoke. So you can get an aspect of modularity. You can take two townhouses and kind of build it into a townhouse that's double the size and so on and so forth. But because it's got very unique shapes, you reduce some of it. And so you make that design decision. It's kind of like, do I want the pitch of the roof to be a perfect triangle? If it is, it becomes a lot more modular. But then I lose that beautiful fantasy curve, which gives it all the style and stuff. So I make a choice, style over function. Knowing full well, it's still going to be completely functional. You can still mod it. You can still make it bigger and smaller, but it will look better. The aesthetics are important. And then I just see it in my head, and that's it. I just see it in my head. And what I do is I go straight to a graphics tablet and I just draw the artwork. And as I'm drawing the artwork, I draw straight onto the screen. So I've got like a pen display, like a Wacom big thing. And I just draw directly onto the screen. As I'm doing the artwork, I draw the die cut lines that China will use.
No kidding.
To cut the shape that you need to do. And normally you'd send something to China and say, here's a thing, make the die cuts from that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they just can't make it precise enough. So I draw the die cut lines and I have to get it and I get it accurate to within a pixel, basically on the screen, at 300 resolution. And they copy that and they can get it. There's a slight tolerance in there, but it's fractions of a millimeter. And so I draw it directly on there. And then when I've done, I actually just print it out at home, mount it on cardboard, cut it out, and then it just fits together. As I'm fitting it together for the first time, sometimes I'll need to make an adjustment. Ooh, you know, that slot needs to move over slightly. So as I adjust it on the prototype, I would then I'll have my screen open. I'll be like, I'll adjust that and I'll tick it off as I go.
Got it.
But generally, if it's something reasonably simple like the townhouse, in fact, I don't think I made any adjustments on the townhouse. I just drew it straight on the screen, cut it out, and it worked. Where normally people would use like CAD or something to kind of work the 3D-ness out. I don't do that, but I don't know how to do that. So I design it in my head. I think about how it looks. I draw the tool in for China and the artwork at the same time. I print it, I prototype it, I build it. And actually, that's what you see on the Kickstarter when you're seeing the photograph. That's my prototype. So I build all of that by hand.
Interesting.
And then China obviously print it. They print it and cut it and send it to me, and I test it all to make sure it's all correct, sign it off, and then that's how your product arrives. It's just an exact copy of what I built.
So, you know, you said it, that's not the normal process, right? Normally it's a reverse engineering. You start, you know, sketching out the 3D and then you go backwards to flatten it out. I've had people on the show that do MDF, and that's what they talk about with MDF.
Yes, but I think I heard one of your recent
the guys from TT Combat, Lewis from TT Combat was on.
Yeah, yep. And they talk about how they put their new guys straight onto the cutting machines and stuff like that. Yeah. None of that here, unfortunately.
That's funny. But so do you think that it's is just the way that your brain works now, that you're able to kind of skip those steps and design flat for 3D right out of the gate? Or is it, I guess what I'm wondering, is there something innate in you, or is it just experience at this point?
Unfortunately, nobody knows. I don't think, I think the rest of the crew, like Wayne and Stu and stuff like that, they just think I'm a bit weird. And I think that's that's ultimately what it comes down to. I think I'm just a very 3D guy from when I was a kid. No doubt building all of the stuff as I, you know, in my childhood, you know, Lego would have been into it, you know, would have played a part probably. But a lot of, when I was younger, I didn't have like a great deal of money. So, you know, I might have a few Star Wars figures or whatever, but I wouldn't have the full set. So often I was big into Transformers, but I really couldn't afford them. And actually some of the robots that they transformed into were rubbish anyway, so I didn't like them. So I ended up sort of building my Transformers out of paper.
And that's something.
And so, you know, I spent a lot of time kind of building stuff. So maybe it's something that's inherent in me, but also it's probably been nurtured through creating stuff that I want to play with that probably couldn't afford maybe. Or just didn't exist often is the case. And then when it come to doing this, trying to think back to the very early battle system stuff, it would be the same again. I would have just drawn it directly onto the screen and printed it and stuff.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting. By want or necessity, it sounds like you had a lot of DIY growing up, right? So you kind of went through, you prototyped this process for several years in your childhood.
I did. I don't think I ever found it difficult. I don't ever remember having issues, if you know what I mean. I wouldn't, you know, it, everything I made. I don't remember having disasters, you know, I'm going to make a line of Transformers and then it didn't happen. I just did it. I don't remember any screwed up stuff like lying by the side of the, I just remember, it might be my selective memory, or maybe I just remember the successes, which is also maybe not a bad thing. But no. Yeah, I definitely spent a lot of time building stuff when I was a kid, scissors, paper, cardboard, scalpels a bit when I was a bit older, I guess. Did a lot of, I used to, you know, obviously as a getting into 40K, I did a lot of scratch building of stuff, you know, buildings out of yogurt pots and all that kind of, all the stuff that was in the books and other stuff. So it must have had, an impact, but yeah.
Well, and that's a different era too of tabletop gaming, and you and I are the same age. GW doesn't do it anymore, but GW used to put out books on how to create from scratch your own terrain. And it was a very common thing, you know, here's how you make trees using felt and this, you know, and here's how you make buildings using Pringles cans and so on and so forth, which they don't do anymore because they sell the terrain now. But yeah, when I was your age, when I was getting into tabletop gaming, you couldn't buy terrain. You had to build it. So I completely understand that. So guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to talk to Colin a little bit more about what it's like to be in the business, and I want to dive into what it's like to run a Kickstarter. So we'll be right back. Howdy friends, Craig here. You deserve a new playmat. Here on the third floor, we use Mats by Mars. They are scratch resistant, waterproof, wet erase marker compatible, almost free of glare, and lighter than neoprene. Mats by Mars gives you over 40 designs to choose from. You pick a mat, pick a design, and then you pick an overlay, like one for Marvel Crisis Protocol, Star Wars Legion, or even Malifaux 3rd Edition. Those overlays will really speed up your deployment and make the placement of objective markers so easy. Use our promotion code in the show notes to get a 10% discount on your first order. In the notes of your order, you can even request the third floor logo on your mat for free. That makes the best mat in the business even a little better. So get some new mats, save yourself some money, and help support the show. Go to matsbymars.com. All the details are in the show notes, including the discount code. So I know that there's people listening, Colin, that are like, man, you know, I hear Craig interview all these people to make a living in this business. That's got to be the greatest thing. You never have to work a day in your life. And, you know, all they do is play games all day. But I have talked to enough people that I know that's not the case. So let's go back, Colin, to you started doing this on the side. Right. Battle systems exist, but it's not something that you're using to support you and yours. It's something that you're doing on the side. I would first like to know, was it, I don't want to do what I'm doing for a job, so I'm going to put more effort into battle systems? Or did battle systems just start to grow to the point where it was just like, look, you, Colin, you need to make a decision. You know, you're not going to be able to do both.
Okay. So I think if I'm completely honest with myself, which I guess I better be at this age, I think that I've always been miserable working for other people, you know, never been happy just doing, you know, you wouldn't know it to see me at work because my job was standing up in front of people and presenting and kind of like, you know, selling, being the corporate brand kind of thing. But, yeah, I was absolutely miserable to be honest. I would say the drive, it's possible that I certainly wouldn't have been sure whether battle systems was going to work for me, but I think I just had this thing of like, well, if it at least makes me feel better and it increases, you know, some sort of benefit for the family at the same time, then I kind of get, the family get a benefit from that, and then I get the benefit of doing something creative. Because when you're not doing, if you're a creative person, you're not doing something creative, it just drives you nuts. I mean, it just makes you miserable, you get depressed, and it just, yeah. So I think that, I think the success of the first Kickstarter, so up until the first Kickstarter, I think I was kind of like, okay, this is, I'll keep doing this. Maybe it'll slowly grow over years, maybe it won't. But I wasn't sure what was going to happen. When we did the first Kickstarter, it went really well. Having had that help, I said from Chris, I knew that the money on the screen is really not, you know, you can't look at that money and just go, oh my God, I'm loaded. You know, it's great. You know, no, that doesn't work at all. And I knew that going in. So, but I also knew that the market was there and wanted what it was that I create for myself. So I was like, so I need to find out now whether this is like just a one-off or whether it is, you know, and so as you go through that Kickstarter process, you realize that, no, there's something going on here. So at that point, I think sometime just after the first Kickstarter, I was like, right, at the time it was kind of I was registered as self-employed and employed. So, and at that point, I was like, right, I need to turn this into a company first of all. So we're protected, a limited company, so that it becomes its own thing in case anything goes wrong, the family protected, you know, the usual boring business stuff. And so I did that. I put it into a limited company, and then I just like really, really careful, and because I have my day job, I didn't need it to make money to pay me necessarily. Although that, you know, at that point there was actually two of us. I got a long-term friend of mine, Wayne, who is, you know, very early original Battle Systems, who would be doing like the website, and you know, I'd need some Photoshop stuff, tooling, redrawn in Illustrator, in AI kind of thing. He knew that. Great. Let's make that work. But apart from that, I didn't need to take any money, and so I just kind of kept doing the Battle Systems thing and letting that go in. And then once everybody's got everything they want, and we checked, we've got all our damage and 10% of damages, and you paid your taxes and all of that kind of stuff, the money that's left over, I was like, well, I'll go and put that over there, and then I'll do it again. And I just kept doing that until it got to the point where I think I knew after a year, after a year after the Kickstarter, that I could have finished my job, my day job. But I think because I had like three kids and a mortgage and everything else, I was like, well, what happens if it all goes wrong? This money over here would only last for this amount of time. And so what would happen is I would have to get another job. And I spent 20 years building up myself up in this job. You know, you've got all this usual fear that kind of grinds down on your shoulders. So so I just kept doing it until it got to the point where it's like, right, if it goes all wrong now, you know, so at this point I've been running my Battle Systems as a limited company for 3 years.
Wow.
And also I was still working in this other place, and I was like, right, okay, I think now if it all went, I couldn't see how it would go wrong, but if it all went wrong, I'd be like, right, I'd have 4 years or 5 years before that run out over there, and I could support the family while I built up. And that's, it gave me a chance to do something else creative that was working for myself. So that is when I was kind of like, see you guys later, I'm done. But the other thing as well is that, of course, what was happening is I'm getting up at maybe 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning for my day job, and I'm traveling maybe 45 minutes, but sometimes 3 hours into London. So in the UK, that's like, you know, a couple of hundred miles away.
Sure.
I'm driving down there and I'm doing a full day presentating in front of people, which is absolutely showering, you know, because you're up there selling and enthusiastic.
It's exhausting.
It is exhausting, yeah. And then you finish that. I've got another big drive home. So I'm getting home at like 7, 8 o'clock at night. I'm having some tea, seeing the kids into bed. And then I'm sitting and going, right, now I've got to work on Battle Systems. So I'll then work till like midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, then get up at 5, 6. And so it's getting to the point where my body's just not going to take that for much longer. And the work was from Battle Systems was just, the demand was so high that I just couldn't do the two together. But it was a good profitable business. So I was like, okay, not only do I have, you know, it's safe for me to stop my day job now, but I absolutely need to, because if I don't, Battle Systems won't grow anymore because I won't be giving it enough time. But also, I'll just fall down.
Yeah.
You know, I'll collapse. So I had to, and I was exhausted. I mean, I was, you know, I was working ridiculous, you know, I was just, like I just said, up at 5 and into bed at 1 o'clock in the morning. So it's not a healthy lifestyle. It's a very short-term sacrifice because you think when you finish work that you're going to be, you know, oh, now I've got all this time to work on Battle Systems. It's going to be great. I'm going to be like getting up when I want. And well, I never thought that, obviously, having, you know, worked in a business, but you just think it's going to be easier, and it kind of gets harder. It's weird.
Well, I can imagine so. And then, you know, the other piece of that too, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would imagine the reality of the business piece becomes a much bigger part of it, right? You know, when it's something on the side, the business aspect of it is a necessary evil, but when it becomes how you support yourself and your family, the business part becomes maybe the most important part. And that stuff isn't necessarily creative or exciting. Paying bills.
It isn't. Yeah. You know, I mean, as a creative person, I really still do like a good spreadsheet. You know, I love an Excel shared spreadsheet. Every time I've got this idea for a project, something like that, the businessman in me kicks in and I'm kind of like, well, if we do this and we do that, and I love to pull the cost together, get a quote from China and do all of that stuff. It's all good stuff. But at that point, making all that happen is, it's hard work because I'm doing all the artwork, I'm doing all the design, I'm literally creating the products from scratch. And then what happens is I've then got to run the business side of it as well. All the boring, the spreadsheets and paying the bills and the tax and the VAT was a nightmare back then as well. And of course, preparing for a Kickstarter while running Kickstars. And actually the whole thing really, I went from working, 15-hour days, as I described before, to working 15-hour days on battle systems because it's just what the company needed. And the thing is, and it's always the way with a business, is the fact that no matter how much you love your business, you've got two aspects. You've got the reason for the business, the creativity, the fun, the ethics, everything behind the business and the reason you're there, the passion. And then you've got what I call the piece of paper. And the business is not an emotional human being with thoughts and stuff. The business is just an animal and it is just a piece of paper. And the piece of paper only cares about the bottom line. And it doesn't care how many hours you're working. It just knows that there's an opportunity over there and if it wants to succeed as it needs to, then it has to. If you want this much, if you want 90% of your success, then you need to put this in. It doesn't care who you are. It doesn't care if you die and then someone else replaces you. It has no emotions. It's not a thing, So you have the piece of paper that is the business, and then you have the creativity around it. And that is a tough bit. And that was really hard to manage. But ultimately. We don't have like big business premises or anything like that. And even to this day, we still work from home. Mm-hmm. So, but there's four of us now. I've got one guy that, Stuart, who's absolutely brilliant. He basically, he does his best to kind of take off of me all of the stuff that, so basically, I'm a bottleneck for the company. So this is a big thing. This is a bottleneck for the company, and it's kind of like right. We need to do all these things. Like right, okay. Well, if I don't die, I can manage to do these things within this set year. So we've got like a 5-year plan, and it's always moving forward and changing a lot. And we're kind of like right, I can do this. This is what I can do, and that's the maximum output Battle Systems can give you. And so his kind of job is to kind of, not his job, but he kind of takes as much, he takes away anything from me that isn't my product. And I've tried to find people to kind of help me with what I do. But the trouble is that everyone's like, okay, well, show me your CAD stuff and stuff. I was like, well, I don't have the CAD. It's all in my head. So I can't, it's very difficult to find somebody who works in the way that I work. So if I'm going to.
It's limiting, isn't it, Colin?
It is limited. In one respect, it's limited. For me, for help, it's limiting. I'm not saying there's not people out there that can do it. There must be. But the thing is that if, having kind of spoke to some people and so on and so forth, and I've kind of showed them something like in the Fantasy Train, I'll give you an example. In the Fantasy Train, we've got a Wizard's Tower. Really lovely, beautiful piece. And like all of the stuff, you can lift off the top. You can even open the tower and see all the multiple floors in it. Absolutely beautiful piece. Now, speaking to some people in the industry, I said, look, how long would it take you? If I said to you I wanted a Wizard's Tower, how long would it take you to design that? And they're like, well, I wouldn't design it. This person would design it, and then we'll get this person to do the artwork, and then this person would... Okay, I said, all right, okay, so what's the time frame involved? They say, well, you're looking at like 3 weeks to design the shapes and the things to slide together. You're probably looking, 2 to 3 weeks for the artwork to go on it. Then you're going to have like, a month's worth of prototyping and building and correcting stuff. And you can't have 3 months to build this thing. That Wizard's Tower, when we was running the Kickstarter, never existed even at the beginning of the Kickstarter. And about halfway through, we're kind of like, right, everyone wants a Wizard's Tower. I'll make a Wizard's Tower. So I kind of drew it and I built it, and it took me 5 days to create the Wizard's Tower.
Amazing.
On the Kickstarter as you see it. So that's the tooling, and that includes building it and photographing it as well.
Right.
So I can't find someone who can do that for me. But I also wouldn't want to bring someone in who could do it that's going to take
3 months.
Have to keep passing it around to other people and do X, yep. Y, Z. Because as far as I'm concerned, that is not that's just not fast enough. So I'm very fast at what I do, but I'm also a bottleneck because I've got so many ideas that I want to do. So I kind of, if it's not something that, if it's something I can farm out, I will farm out to like an artist or whatever, you know. So with the terrain, it's all me, everything me. With our games where I'm doing concept characters, I'm designing content. I'm if you take original core space, for example, all but one of those characters are all my design. So I'll do all the concept drawings and all the blah, 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 blah. But in order to then do the final coloured artwork, I can do that as well. However, it takes me 12 hours and there was 48 per character, final colours. And there's 48 characters. So straight away, you've got 48 slots of 12 hours, which for me is 48 days.
Sure.
With 3 hour break, you know. So but I don't have to do that. So we passed that off to a guy in America, Nick Greenwood, who's an amazing artist, done some amazing stuff. And so I kind of palm stuff off. I'll still have control of the characters, what they look like, but we'll pass it to Nick, who can do that. While he's doing that, I can do the stuff that other people can't do, the terrain and all the things that need to be done. So it's a weird, but I'm stuck in this bottleneck, but I've got some great help. I've got Stuart, who looks after the business side of it and is doing more and more and more. And we've got someone who looks after retail. And we've got Wayne, of course, who's still doing all of the, he does all of the lore and the story. So
that's awesome.
I will kind of be like, look, this is what it is. This is what it looks like. These are the things, da, 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 da. This is what they do. I'm all about function. I know how they work. I'm all about the mechanics. I know the technology. I know the da, 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 da. I was like, right, let's wrap that in a really interesting story. You know, it's like here's all these really cool things, and I think they're coming from here, and this is what's going to happen, and this is where it's going. We can't mention this, and I pass all that stuff over. I'm like, go.
And it's there. And somehow Wayne comes up with it, huh?
Well, Wayne's really good at the story and the lore, you see. So he's kind of like a writer. He's an artist as well, but he's a writer. So yeah. What he would do, he kind of brings that all together. And he'll come back and go, I really like this idea and blah, 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 blah. And we'll have some discussions, probably some quite heated discussions. We've certainly had at least one or two arguments over gravity at some point. And I'm kind of like, yes, I know gravity doesn't work like it does in Star Wars. I know we need this central thing and I know it needs to do that. And I'm all about practical. You know, core space is all about basing it in a certain amount of reality. But however, you know, mechanically for some games, you just need to go with kind of the Star Wars approach and go, yes, explosions impact in space. And yeah, don't worry why gravity's on all the ships. Let's just not worry
That's
about
funny.
It. I know they're not spinning. You know, don't worry about it.
So you got hooked up with the guys at Modiphius, and they were kind enough to sit down and give you some tips and some direction on the Kickstarter. And how many Kickstarters have you done at this point now, Colin?
Oh God, I don't know. It feels like about 50, but it really isn't any. It's like I think we've done like 8 or something.
Okay.
But we just tend to do one a year. We like to do it properly. People really cram Kickstarters in, and they'll deliver projects before they finish another one and stuff like that. And that's what the business. That's what the piece of paper wants you to do. The brains behind it basically says, nope, not if you want to survive, you know? So,
yeah, no, it was a well-run Kickstarter. And, even the customer service I got afterwards was excellent, by the way.
Excellent. That's great.
But, so if we go look at your first Kickstarter,
yeah,
and we look at the 8th one, what mm-hmm. is the learn there? So what did you do in your 8th Kickstarter because you had gotten good at this that you didn't do in your first one? I'd like to get a sense of what's changed for you as somebody who uses Kickstarter as a business model.
Okay. So, a very first Kickstarter, I just went on it and we put up a funding level. I can't remember what it was. I think it's like 23 grand or something. And I was like, if we can do that in 30 days, then that's no problem. And I think we did it in 4 hours. And then, so I was like, oh, great. I think, you know. And then I think on day 3 or 4, we got to a point. It's like, right, I now need to register the company for VAT taxes, which I didn't have to do because we broke brackets. So that I'm kind of like, wow, this is going really good. And at the same time, I'm like, oh, my God, you know. This is a little bit more responsibility and stuff. I'm used to big responsibility in the other company, but it's different when it's your own, when it's your own family and everything. So I kind of, what was different? Well, it was interesting. I got all that help from Chris, personally from Chris, who owns and runs Modiphius. You know, he's the guy that sort of created that company. And I just basically had that as bullet points and just said, right, I need to follow this. So I didn't overpromise and underdeliver, and I kept it simple and I kept it. And as we were running the Kickstarter, really what happened, the supporters, especially a lot of the ones that we'd kind of got to chat into on Facebook, we spent a lot of time just speaking to the people that wanted this product, or this project, should I say, as it wasn't really a product at that point.
Sure.
They kind of on Facebook, they told us, oh, maybe it'd be really good for this. A lot of games use this grid thing and we should do. And I thought, okay, I'll see if I can integrate that. So we just did a lot of listening first of all, and I kind of put it together. And then when the Kickstarter was running, we got funded, and, you know, and then people were like, oh, you need to do an update. I was like, do I? Oh yeah, you need. And so we just listened to the supporters who had all the Kickstarter experience and just like,
yeah.
And literally by the end of the first Kickstarter, you kind of feel like a Kickstarter expert. And you look back at the beginning of the 31 days back then, I think it was, you know, and I was just like, wow, if I'd known that going in, it didn't matter because I adjusted really quickly. And we ran out of stuff to show them very quickly. And that's where me making stuff while the Kickstarter is running came from. You know, it's just like, wow, we've run out of stuff. Okay, stretch goals. What do we need to do? Wayne's looking at me like, you know, Carl, I don't know what to do, man. You know, it's like, you know, we've got like, we've still got another 28 days and you haven't given me anything else. So I do this, he calls it Colin Foo, but I basically go really dark and I just like, and I said, just keep him happy on the comments. And I was like, oh. And I'm sitting there and he's just like panicking, literally sweating to the point where he's sending me emails like, Carl, literally, I don't know what to talk about anymore. This is on the original Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And then suddenly a load of photographs are arriving. It's like I built on Arrival Bay or something. And it's like, why didn't you show me that before? I was like, it didn't exist before. So we kind of like, and he then puts that up on the update. And of course, and you think, right, that'll keep me busy for the next 10 days. But of course, what it does, it kind of drives the Kickstarter. So suddenly the Kickstarter funds go up and Wayne's like, that ain't going to last 10 days. And I'm like, what do you mean? He says, I think probably by tomorrow afternoon it's going to be. I was like, oh my God. So I'm back on the table and I'm scalping away. And, you know, but at the same time, I've got Chris's voice in my head from the original conversation. Don't overpromise, don't under the yeah. Think about the shipping weight, you know, what's coming on. Make sure you communicate clearly. Make sure that you don't, you know, overpromise and underdeliver is the big thing.
Yeah.
And so I've got all that going on at the same time, and we get to the end of it. We did really, really well. And we're sitting there and I'm just like, right, I think it's like midnight we did it for, or UK finishing midnight. I was like, right, I'm going to bed, that's it. You wake up the next morning, you just look back across the Kickstarter and go, right, somehow I've got to do that. And I had manufacturers kind of set up and stuff, but you know, I was still at a point where I was like, I don't even know if they're really going to be able to do this thing over here, because I'm building it and going, wow, that's a really small tolerance for a die cut tool, can they do that, you know? So
I'm, yeah,
you know, and so I was we took an approach to say that we're not going to skimp on anything, which is basically say, will you, you know, we got quotes from China, which would have saved us a lot of money, but we didn't. We went for the big professional factories at first to make sure that we, you know, less profit, but better product for the customer.
Yep.
And so we kind of did it that way. And that has been our, and that is still our process today. I could get our terrain, for example, manufactured at much better better prices, but there would be an issue on quality.
A trade-off.
And you know, and I think maybe some companies would be happy with the trade-off because of the business, the bottom line, and I don't know, maybe there's shareholders involved or whatever. I don't have any of that, so I'm just like, nope, it's got to be perfect. What's perfect is like, nothing's ever perfect, but you know, as perfect as I can be. So that was the first Kickstarter. By the time we get to, let's say, the last one we've done, which is the Core Space Firstborn, our second Core Space Kickstarter, that was just as stressful in many respects. The difference there is that I've got, there's like four of us. So you've got Wayne making sure stuff goes on the page. I've got Stuart writing all the updates just managing the tool. So Stuart would come to me and go, right, I need this. I don't want it more than this many sheets. I don't need that. Da, da, da. And then he'll say go. And then I'm like, right. It's like, right, whatever it's going to be. And then I hand it back to him and he's like, oh, okay, great. That's not what I was expecting. I was like, oh no, really? He's like, no, it's great. It's brilliant. But that's not how I saw a Wizard's Tower, or that's
sure.
not how I said, but it looks better than what I thought, you know? So that was fine. Cause there's kind of a twist that I put on things. And so that, all of that still exists. But the difference is we're just more organized. We've got more experience. And so the pressures are the same. The hours are the same. The stresses in that respect are the same. The difference is really about presentation. The Kickstarter, if you look at our very first Kickstarter page and our latest one, is a lot clearer because yeah. of people like Stu and Wayne making sure that the message is clearer to the backers and the supporters. And it's about having, you know, you can see a development in the product, you know, the miniatures and how we present it. You know, the original course-based miniatures on the Kickstarter, they look good. And the ones that we've got, the firstborn, are also good. They're both amazing miniatures,
right.
but they look better on the latest Kickstarter because we present them better. Right. You know, we've got better renders and, you know,
yeah.
So there's a lot, and there's almost too much to list. You know, you could look at just a Kickstarter banner on a page that shows you what you get in the pledge. And there's so many things you can do with that banner to make sure that it's understandable. One of the biggest mistakes people make is they'll have a fantastic miniature and they'll, you know, a 32 millimeter miniature, but on the banner that, you know, on the screen when it's open, it's like 70 millimeters tall because you're looking at it, and it doesn't matter how greatly detailed that is, it makes the miniature look not as good, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's all sorts of rules like don't try not to show a miniature at bigger than the scale it would be when you get it, because it will just look better, it will look cooler.
Sure.
And actually now our miniatures are getting so kind of detailed and nice that we can kind of show them a bit taller and have a little bit more size to it and just go, and it still looks really good. So I think the biggest, all of the stresses stay the same, but it really is just knowing what to expect,
I was about to say, I would imagine you're more prepared, right? So it doesn't change the pressures, but at least being psychologically prepared for it might be a better situation.
Yeah, definitely. And I think for me personally, I find the Kickstarter is a lot less stressful now. I mean, they're still stressful because I'm having to build stuff as we go. And as much as it's fun, it's really hard work. And it's a pressure because it's like, wow, what if this doesn't work? You know, because once I put so much time into it, it's like, right, we need it today. It's like, well, it didn't work. It's like, so I'm going to need another 2 days. You can't do that on Kickstarter. So that hasn't happened so far. But I try not to look at the Kickstarter page too much. So I just focus on what I'm building. And I look at the page once a day. And it's less stressful because it's always an upturn, you know, and I don't see the dips and the troughs, which stress me out, you know, as Kickstarter goes up and down, you know, and I avoid any like negative, because we don't get very many negative comments, but I try to avoid those. So I get shielded a little bit.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, guys, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to talk to Colin about creating a game. So not only has he been responsible for starting a company that puts out some gorgeous terrain, but they've got a game called Core Space, and I want to talk about that. We'll be right back. Right now is the part of many podcasts where someone comes on, interrupts the show, and explains that you should consider paying for the content you're already getting for free. They'll go on and explain that by giving a dollar or more a month, you not only support the show, but you allow the show to grow and improve. Here on the Third Floor, we commit to not interrupting your episode of Tabletop Talk with such a plea. We pledge not to run a spot asking you to go to patreon.com and give a dollar or more a month. Even if there is a link in this show's description, and there is, we won't ask you to click it and become a patron. We won't spend time yammering about the benefits like early access to episodes, getting those episodes without ad breaks, or even getting a chance to play in one of Craig's RPG sessions. Anyway, enjoy this episode. We needed to clarify that we wouldn't do this type of solicitation. Time for a quick shout out to our most recent patrons. A big thank you goes out to Peter Sojnek, Nathan E. Hoyle, Jimmy CZ, Wayne Peacock, Oliver Borden, Zachary Wills, J. Douglas Nielsen, Patrick Healy, Ifrit V. Diablo, Greg Packman, Eric Conrad, and Joe Root. Because of them and the 100 plus other patrons, we're able to put out content to you on a regular basis. Thank you.
Hi there, this is Owen from the Nova Open, and I am a $5 patron of Third Floor Wars because I love supporting the whole Malifaux community. I want to help Craig and the whole Third Floor Wars team continue making the fantastic content that gets me through my daily commute. you should join me in supporting the show. Just pause this episode, head to patreon.com and search Third Floor Wars, or grab the link in the show notes. See you there.
I have guesses on what may have led to Core Space, but instead of guessing, I'm just going to ask the question. Was it a situation where you made some cool terrain and go, oh boy, I bet it'd be cool if we could play this game on this terrain? Or did the idea of the game always was there and you decided to go for it? So where does I'm not going to make just terrain anymore, I'm going to actually design a game, where does that come from?
It's kind of a weird one, because actually the reason I started Battle Systems in the first place was so that I could make the games that I wanted to make.
Interesting.
So that was the process. However, having done a few shows showing off my stuff and meeting, you know, people who run companies like Chris and Ronnie from Mantic and stuff like that, you know in advance that putting a game together is not as easy as what people think. Oh, I'll get some miniature sculpted and I'll throw some rules together and this will be my game. You can do that. But if you want the game to be successful, which I'm really passionate about, not just because it's a business and I want to make the money, it's the game that I've always wanted to create. So you want it to be successful. And so really, I wanted to do a game straight away, but I just knew that I wouldn't have the experience and I've got to take my time. So I did what I could do best, which was the terrain, and I worked my way. And it wasn't until I'd done, you know, four, maybe five Kickstarters, I forget. Maybe Core Space was the fifth one. And that was when I was like, right, now I'm ready for a game. At this point, I'd spoken to sculptors and got, you know, some miniatures done, and, you know, I'd bought like a 3D printer and was just like messing around and doing all of this kind of stuff. But the actual game came way before Battle Systems.
Interesting.
I mentioned earlier on that, you know, I would often, the games that I would buy miniatures for, I would immediately adapt the games to suit my playstyle. It kind of started with that, really, but I was a massive Star Wars fan and I always wanted Star Wars miniatures, and I had the little 25mm West End Coast ones, and, you know, when I was really young. And then I kind of lost them and I started sculpting my own kind of stuff, and because I wanted to play Star Wars again in miniature style. And then I think it was Wizards of the Coast, is it, brought out the pre-painted Star Wars, like the D&D miniatures. And I was like, oh my God, this is it. It was another one of those moments where this is what I've always wanted. So I started buying all this stuff out. I spent thousands on that stuff. It was ridiculous. But I got the characters I wanted and I started playing that. And what happened is that I have this kind of rule system, which I've always used, which is the same system that you get in Core Space. And it's a system that supports a small band of people. So in Star Wars, it'd be maybe Luke and Han and a few little rebel troopers. And it'll be like them against a lot more people. That was how it, you know, a horde of stormtroopers. So you get this real heroic kind of thing going on. And I made sure of certain things. Like I always liked having ammo or charging weapons or whatever. And I had, for Star Wars, I had like the Force, you know, which in Core Space becomes skill pegs, and I had health and all these different things. And so it meant that the NPCs were a much more simple mechanic, which were controlled by the game rather than another player. And then you would have me playing this band of whoever. And like I said, it could be a Star Wars thing. And then I adapted it to a Judge Dredd game and a Batman game and a Hellboy game.
Yeah.
And it immediately moves and adapts, because the core rules of Core Space work with kind of any system if you want to do it. You then just, all you really have to do is kind of like remove the story and replace it with different characters and maybe tweak some of the mechanics. So, you know, like I said, in my Star Wars game, I had these Force pegs on the dashboard. And what I did, I replaced them with, in Core Space, it becomes skill pegs. You know, your ability to kind of, you know, be good at close combat or, you know, stealth or whatever, you know. And so really, I wanted to do a game early on, but I just wasn't ready for it. So by the time I did do the game, I was definitely ready for it. And I think that really shows in Core Space. And I wanted a game that had all of the depth of a kind of a role-playing game, but with the fast-paced kind of speed of a kind of a zombie-side kind of game, you know, where you could just move and have all the action without loads of rule books and
right.
big long discussions and stuff like that still can happen, but you know, you just have to. And so I wanted the depth, and that's where I kind of really delved into to Core Space. And again, I called on our supporters of our Kickstarter, and I called on the Facebook guys and stuff like that, and I just invited them round, and I made a using our city block, our urban terrain, I made a game, a kind of apocalyptic game where you're a bunch of survivors and going against zombies. But I used this mechanic and tested it with them, and they really loved it, and it was really simple and fast to play. And when they finished, I was like, well, you know what? You can level that character up, and you can do this, and you can do that. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And once I knew that they were enjoying, because there's always that things like, maybe I'm the only one who likes to play like this. Because I couldn't see any other games out there like this. And I was like, well, there might be a very logical business reason for that. But I thought, yeah, now, you know, like my terrain, people seem to like it. I'm sure they're going to like this. And so I just went straight in with the belief that people will enjoy Core Space. And I just put all of my 20 years worth of what I've been wanting to do with this straight into Core Space. And I took out the stuff that wasn't needed, and I put in everything that I was. And then I play tested it to death until I was really happy with the system. And yeah, that's how I kind of went. It really was. I've always wanted to do the game, but I just didn't want to do it wrong.
So you say, you know, the Core Space that I could buy today is in many ways very similar to the center game that you played 20 years ago, right? That these core mechanics have been part of how you played. So what are those? So if you were to distill down, what is the essence that didn't change? What would that be?
Okay, so I really see it as my book of physics, really. So in the same way that, you know, you look at the world and everything's governed by the laws of physics, you know, you can do various different things, but it's kind of, you're kind of cemented down. And that's how I see the Core Space rule book, really. So there's some very simple stuff, things that people would be very, very used to, like movement, you know. So you've got, you know, within reason, most characters have got like two actions, you know, and you can do your usual thing. You can move this set amount of space. You can take this many actions. You can attack this thing. You can interact with this item over here. You can throw something. You can pick something up. You can drag it. You can open this thing. You know, so you've got all these kind of basic actions. And it kind of, it wraps itself up in the way the game plays. So often, you would have, so for example, each character has its own little dashboard, and on that dashboard you'll get a character card, and that character card will just be the character, and because of the personality of that character, he will have like a points value, and that's the best that character could ever be if you advance him, and so on and so forth. You get strong characters, just like physics in real life. You get very strong big guys, and you get like really brainy kind of, you know, it's that. And I kind of this is going to sound weird now, but I kind of see people like this. I mentioned it to the people I used to work with, and they just think I'm nuts, but hopefully people on this podcast might not think so much.
Gamers might get it.
After you get to sort of know people, you kind of, I feel like most people, the average person has got like, you know, 50 points. You know, and they've got like their intelligence and their strength and their endurance, their willpower, all these usual things. And the average person's got 50 points, and they spend it there. You know, you might get, you know, a couple of super people got 60 points, 65 points, and you can get some people that are not so well endowed with points. I'm getting risky here, but what happens is that I kind of see it, and I see people like that, and I'm like, wow, you spent a lot of points over there.
But interesting.
It's affecting over here. And I see myself the same. You know, so if you look at my ability with maybe art and creativity and the things that I feel that I'm good at, I feel like I've spent all my points over there. But if you look at me in other directions, so in battle systems, I'm not allowed to touch words because I'm just terrible at them. I'm horribly dyslexic. If it wasn't for my creative side, I would, you'd have to just lock me away. I wouldn't be good for society. So, but so I feel like I've spent all my points over here.
Sure.
And so, you've got this character card that slots into this dashboard, and that's your character. And they've got a career, and they've got their skills, and they've got their health and their actions and all this sort of stuff. And they've got some abilities that are unique to them, you know, that might give them that little advantage because of their character trait, their alien or whatever, you know. And then underneath that, you get to give them a class board. And this is a little board that basically says, okay, well, here's your core character. Now, this person, what would you like them to be? And it's that almost like classic video game thing. You've got your tech and you've got your soldier and your hunter and your marine and all this kind of stuff. And those skills will be set. And you put that in there. And then underneath, you've got a space for what they can carry. And then underneath that, you've just got three levels of pegs. Which is your health, so it's easy to track, and you've got your skill pegs, which are not infinite in the game. People get exhausted. You can only there's only so many times you can do your special thing before it becomes unspecial. And then you've got your kind of ammo at the bottom. And then you chuck this rookie character along with some other traders into your game, and they slowly, as they go through as you play games with them, they slowly advance, and you get to choose where they're going with their career. You're like, well, I want them a bit more close combat. You might choose someone, a class that's got a lot of that, or you want a tech. And then even once you've chosen that, as you advance, every time you finish a game, you get a career point, you get to allocate that to a new skill. And you can choose even on that class card where that skill. So you might have chosen a tech, but you might want them really good at these tech skills and not so much at these. So you can really kind of, and you develop your character. And so a lot of emphasis comes on the character, and that's the role-playing aspect of it.
I was about to say, that's the RPG aspect.
Yeah, and it's got that development. You've got a lot of control over that. But all of that stuff is kind of done between the games. So you're not bogged down with any of it, and it's kind of iconized as well, which means that there's not lists of text everywhere. And once it's kind of heavy on the icons, but once you get used to your skills that you've got, you can kind of, I'm going to use this skill at the right time. And so you develop your character through that. You develop your whole crew of characters through that. But it plays really fast because of the choices you made between. When you're playing, it plays incredibly fast. You make your choices. So you get this real cinematic kind of narrative to
That's
it.
Great.
And the game kind of creates it. I mean, you'll have a mission and it'll tell you what the objective is, and there'll be a thematic story behind it. But the narrative comes from the game when you're playing it, because situations just happen, you know, whilst you're playing the game with the civilians. All the different types of NPCs are moving around you, a bit like real life. And some of the situations you get in, you're just like, oh, it's like Sod's Law. It's like, why are these civilians suddenly walked into here and done this thing? And, you know, and it's just like real life. And it creates this kind of story as you're playing the game, but it's fast. And when you're done, all the things that you've created and you've salvaged and you've found and et cetera, you then trade and you can advance your crew, and you've got a repair
that's great.
Ship that's falling apart, and you've got to, you know, sometimes you've got to extract your crew, and it goes on and on and on and on.
So I'd be curious, Colin, talking to designers, I've heard, like, you know, 90% of the game is the same as I've gone through all these iterations. But what I've often heard is at the last leg. So whether it be when you've opened up playtesting, you know, you're in the last little bit, the last iteration, there often is a huge discovery. And it might be something that you added, you didn't have, and it was a missing key for so long. Or a lot of times I hear that there's something that was existing the whole time that once you finally cut it, it made the game work. Was there a final like iteration where you said, oh, I finally figured out what was the missing piece, either something I added or took away that really just made it all finally work together? Was there something like that for Core Space?
God, that's a cracking question. And I'm really trying to think of this amazing answer that I can do that question.
Well, sometimes it can be a small thing though.
Yeah. I don't think I can pinpoint a thing where I'm like, wow, we're so glad we took that out of the last minute. That process kind of, maybe it's because that process is handled a lot. Okay. So this might be similar to a lot of people when they're designing games. I know I've got a good friend from a company called Grimlord Games, Adam Smith, and we have this very same kind of process. And what we do is when you play test the game, it's kind of like we've got, like, you know, our iPad here, our notepad or whatever, and you just play through the game. Every time you come to any kind of stumbling block, you make a note, And at the end of the game, we then go through and we change anything that needs to be changed, update a rule on anything that needs to change. So we end up with a new rule book and we play again, sticking to the letter of those rules. And so there's definitely plenty of changes that happen. Oh my God, we have to change this entire concept. But it's always kind of like, you know what, this is either a little bit too powerful or this needs to be removed. But it's a very gradual kind of chipping away at the sculpture. And so by the time we get to just before release or anything, really the game, by the time we get to Kickstarter, the game is really, really kind of solid. So on the Firstborn, which we did, I think, in November, we're still playtesting stuff now. And what happens is I send the stuff to Stuart. Stuart then comes back and puts it in a rule book because, like I said, I'm not allowed to touch words. And right. It's great because I actually get my rule book, which, you know, for me is just scribbles. And I'm like, wow. And then I use his letter of the law to check everything and play the game. And even now while playing, I will go back and go, you know what? I think this thing over here. And he'd be like, yeah, I think we need a new icon for that, which is to do with hover, because this over here doesn't work and it doesn't affect this. And so we tweak it and I go back in and I play. Or the hunters, they're not really getting around the board quick enough. So let's do this with their actions, or let's make them only do this thing in this situation. So there's lots of little tweaks like that. And then I play it again and they go, how did that go? And I'll be like, it's great. They're all over the place. They're right pain, you know, now. They're all getting in your face. Yeah, they feel like they should be, you know. And so there's that process going on. And we also get, like, Wayne will put the characters' bios together as well. So I'll constantly go back and check those and be like, no, this doesn't sound right. And he come back with something else, go, that's right. And then I'll take that bio and I kind of look at their character cards before we go to print. And I'll be like, you know what, I'm going to switch that skill that's inherent on his card because it doesn't go with his bio. Or if I really need that skill on there because it's part of the game, I'll go back and say, you know what, let's not say he's a, you know, this character's in this type of thing because it goes against the mechanic that I need in the game. So we're constantly tweaking. I mean, every week at the moment, we're tweaking small parts of that. So it definitely does happen. But it
sounds like it's more gradual for you, Colin.
It's definitely gradual. And of course, the system has been played for, you know, for me, decades. Yep. So, you know, that's not saying it was perfect. It absolutely wasn't. But it's grounded in this thing that I've played so many times.
Right.
And like I say, even to this day, I'll back a Kickstarter. Hellboy was a great example, you know, and I'll get it through and I'll be like, great, I'll just print myself up some Hellboy cards with the characters on it and I'll convert their skills. And I'll just sit and I'll play that game. I'll use the course-based rulebook and I will play it. And, you know, as you're reading, you're kind of slotting out the non-thematic words and you're putting something else in. So there wasn't really anything in that particular respect. There was a lot of things that I did on purpose because I didn't like it in certain games, but nothing that changed at the last minute.
So, out of curiosity's sake, when you think about the game exposure, so, and I think about it as concentric circles, right? So it starts off, it's in Colin's head, only Colin plays this game, and that's the universe, right? Then the circle gets a little bit bigger as you show somebody else the game and you teach them how to play it. Then you get to play testing and the circle gets bigger. But then when that thing is released, the circle is exponentially larger when it's out in the wild and people are playing it. When that happened with Core Space, what came back that surprised you? What did you not anticipate?
Okay. This was the thing I was most scared about, because everybody I spoke to in the industry basically just said, your first version of the game is going to...
garbage.
They're going to find stuff that you just didn't know or don't like or whatever. And so I was really kind of prepared for this huge backlash. But I was also, from a business point of view, it's like, it's fine. If that's what we need to get this to where it needs to be, maybe it's too introverted. I play it. Everyone has a certain play style, for example, you know.
Right.
And I think what surprised me the most was the just the love from the community of the game when it went out there. And, you know, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, oh, we're great, Battle Systems are great, we do this great game and everybody loves it.
Well, I hear you're a fan of Battle Systems.
Yeah, exactly. But
it's okay to like what you do.
Yeah, but you know, we can't. I think the thing that surprised me was, is, you know, if I'm being honest, is just the lack of bad reviews.
That's
you
good.
You just can't find a good bad review, you know. So everybody's, you know, there's certain criticisms, you know, and some of those things we tweaked, like in a different version, you know, and we've got like a little errata thing, you know, and some of that. But really, it was just watching people play the game and watching them learn that you can't play Core Space the way that you would might play a normal game. So normally people get like a bunch of they see them as heroes and they rush in guns blazing. And they're like, wow, I died in like two rounds. I was like, yeah, because these are not your heroic characters. These traders in Core Space, they're just people like you and me who are trying to scrape a living. You know, yeah, what would you do if you ran into a room and these alien robots? What would you do? Well, I'd hide behind that cargo crate and peep up and try and pop them down. We'll do that then, because that's the reality of who you are. You are not this Herculean kind of like superhero.
Let me rephrase the question then for you, Chris or Colin. Let's think about what people loved about it then. Was there aspects of the game that you just didn't anticipate would catch fire? So when you were getting feedback and you were like, you know what? Yeah, like I love that you love that part of the game. I didn't anticipate that, like what surprised you?
Like I said, the thing I remember the most is people's play style. I think what came back was the narratives people got into. I didn't expect them to get the same narrative that I would play. So when people are playing the game, they're like, oh wow, this was really crazy because we went in with our gangers and instantly lost a crew member, so I was really careful after that, and we found this thing over here, but then these civilians come in and he traded, which was great, but then it turned out he was this live one in disguise, and I had to do, and so we all had to run out of this thing, and just as we got here, a load of gangers turn up, and they were kind of putting pressure, but then the police turned out and started taking on the gangers, and the gangers had infight, you know, and this is all controlled by the game, and it kind of like, and when they got back, they're playing the game like me. They're basically saying, yeah, they're talking about the characters the same way that I speak about them. So they weren't saying, oh, my captain, this happened to my captain, and I had to extract them very mechanically using rule number 7, subsection 5. You know, it was kind of like, it was all kind of like, oh, you know, Captain Weaver was up to his usual stuff and he just didn't give a crap about this and he left this guy for dead and he was a new rookie. He shouldn't, you know. And so we're having this kind of thematic, and what surprised me was is that I kept being told that people who play games are sticklers for the rules, and you know, if it's too washy the rule, you know, not too in a grey area, they'll say it's broken and all. Didn't get any of that. We just got this, you know, both from, you know, professional people and reviewers within the industry, you know, that just got the game and decided to review it.
Yep.
But from at the time of, you know, we've got tens of thousands of people on Facebook and stuff like that. And it was just this positive wash of people just saying, it's great. You know, I think people are really surprised by the what we call the real search as well. And I'm glad that people, that was another thing that I'm glad people really went for. I've got a real bugbear with games is that if you go in and you've got a game and you've got like a character board, as you go through the game, you might pick things up, or I found a knife and I found a gun, and it's a deck of cards. And I go to a room and kind of want to search for something. And if someone gets there first or does something in another room, they then take the card off that deck. And I'm like, if I got there first, I would have got that card. Now, for me, that doesn't, in my brain, that just doesn't work. It's like, but no, that is either in that room or it's not. So one
it's not Schrodinger's knife.
So I'm kind of like, well, why can't I, you know, when I set the board up, if there's something in that room, I want it to be in there at the beginning of the game. And if I don't get it, I want it to be there at the end of the game, and I want to have a look and see what I missed, that kind of thing. So with Core Space, what we have, I mentioned the dashboards and the characters. Underneath the class board, you've got this little strip and where you put your equipment you're carrying. And you really can only carry what you can fit in that strip. You know, so I didn't like computer games where you'll get a character and they're holding like about 15 weapons. And you're like, well, where are they? Because I can't, he's got one on his back. I can't see anything else. That breaks the game for me. I just don't want to play it. So I kind of like, so you set up all the little cargo crates. And the cargo crates, they're real things. You know, they're three-dimensional things, just like Core Space. It's all three-dimensional walls, the whole thing. And when you get in that room, you get your character net, you spend an action, you open the cargo crate, you pick it up, you tip the contents into your hand. It's there. You look at your dashboard. It's like, what can I carry? well, I can only carry those two, but you know what? This thing I'm carrying is not worth as much as that. So you swap it out, you close it, you put the cargo crate back down. You know what was in there. No one else does because your character's in there. And so now I've got this stuff in my dashboard. And I'm like, what do I, and I go to another room. What do I carry? What do I take? I can only carry a certain amount. So you've got to really make that choice. And when I get back, I then sell, you know, obviously I can sell and trade and craft that stuff and use it to repair things and so on and so forth. And I think people were kind of, I was really happy that people were giving the feedback that they really loved the fact that it was there. And at the end of the game, they're like, oh, we never made it to that room. Now, you could, with a deck of cards, you couldn't like go, well, let's pull the next deck, let's, you know, and see what it was. Or someone might shuffle it. It was like, well, it's been moved. But you could literally go there and open it, tip it out and go, oh, my God, if I'd just been a bit more adventurous, I would have got, like, you know, the knife of Galagala or whatever, some magical whatever. You know, so I've kind of like it's that ability to be able – I love the fact that they were kind of sold on this real search and the fact that you can only carry this and it was real. It was very – it's all grounded in this really realistic, you know, kind of stuff. So,
It's got to be neat, Colin, to know that something that was as boring as inventory that you got excited about and that mattered to you, and it has been exciting to see other people latch onto it and notice it as well.
Yeah, a lot of it's just born out of my frustrations of, other games, whether it be a computer game or, you know, a board game. It's just sometimes things just break for me, you know, it breaks the immersion. And maybe it's just me, but I'm all about the immersion, which is why – you know, with Core Space, you get all the 3D scenery in the box because it's like, no, you can't play Core Space without 3D scenery. You can't have beautiful miniatures and not have a real door to open and not be able to, you know. So when you walk into a room, you can immediately see line of sight because there's a wall in the way. And you can duck behind the cargo crate and it covers the miniature. You know, it's like, and it's like, well, it's going to be harder for you to hit me. And everyone knows it's an instant thing. So what happens, you have this immersion. So while you're playing the game, you kind of, everything else around you kind of disappears. And all you can see is these dashboards, which is kind of like your HUD, isn't it, of your characters. And you can see your ammo. You can look at a dashboard and immediately kind of get this, like, split second look at the health of your character as far as what they've got, whether it's worth taking the risk, how much ammo they've got, whether their skills are left, and all this kind of stuff. And you can look back at the board at the room, you can see all of the characters, you can see in a three-dimensional environment, and there's something about that immersion that just makes everything that a little bit more real. And I think that's part of where the narrative comes from as well.
Well, it takes a kid looking at a Rogue Trader for the first time. It takes them back to that moment, right? Where you're just lost in your own little world. So that's fantastic. So Colin, for those listening that are getting as excited about the game as you are talking about it, where is the best place for them to find Core Space?
Okay. So Core Space, you can find it probably in many retail stores. We've got, we can find it on a website, okay? So if you go to, you know, the obvious plug, battlesystems.co.uk, then you'll find it on there. You'll find all of our terrain and everything else you need. You'll also find it in, you know, we do retail all over the world as well. And in fact, we ship all over the world straight from website, but we also are in, you know, retail stores across the world as well. So you search online, you'll find it somewhere. Somewhere local or somewhere that can be shipped from or just get it direct from us. We don't care where you get it. As long as you get it and enjoy playing it, I'm a happy man. So, it should be dead easy to find. It's kind of a weird one because we were very the thing that we got told again many times was be really careful on your second print run because obviously, when you first get something in after Kickstarter, the stock can go pretty quick. And then you're like, oh, wow, if we did that in, you know, if we sold all that in 2 years, or, you know, then we're going to have to, you know, double our doodahs on our numbers. And it just doesn't, you know, it just doesn't work like that. So we was very cautious and we tried to approach it properly. But every time we've reprinted, I think we're on our fourth reprint of the original Core Space.
No kidding.
Now. Yeah. And every time we've had to print more than whatever our last print run was. So for us, it's kind of like it seems to be breaking a lot of the normal retail stuff, which as far as I'm concerned is just a good, you know, a good indication of
validation.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. And I think that's the thing. So You will find it. You will find core space anywhere. And if for whatever reason it's out of stock anywhere, it won't be long because we've got another big shipment coming in. And I think so part of that as well is the fact that we don't just put the game out there. It's not like a game you play and then you put it away. Core space never ends. So it's kind of, we're always supporting it. We put out things like Mission Mondays and
nice.
We support it with additional products, which we self-fund now away from Kickstarter to make sure that you've got more expansions. And there's a whole ton of expansions. So you can really flavor core space the way you want it to be flavored.
That's exciting.
If you want more civilians wandering around like a bit more real life, then you can pop some more of those in. You can do all that kind of stuff. We really do kind of just keep everybody kind of interested in it because I want to. I mean, Core Space is still the game that I play. It's what, you know, it's the reason, you know, to get up in the morning for me, just playing the games, really. If you want to jump in and grab a bit of Core Space, then I would say go to a website first and have a look and learn a little bit more about it. And then grab it from wherever you want, really. We don't mind.
That's great. So, Colin, is there anything on the horizon for Battle Systems that's got you excited right now?
Okay, yeah. So we've got Core Space at the moment, the original Core Space. We've also got our latest Kickstarter, which is Core Space Firstborn, which takes our traders to the complete edge of the galaxy where people don't normally go in the Perseus Arm. That's where Core Space is basically set within a tiny, tiny area. It's massive, obviously, but a tiny area of the Perseus Arm in our galaxy about 1,500 years from now. But they kind of find a way to get to the tip of this other place, and we got this Firstborn. So that I'm really excited about that because I'm getting to play lots of Core Space because I'm doing the final play testing and I'm having these amazing adventures. So that's what I'm excited about.
Yep.
What we're going to be moving to now is one of the things we do when I'm designing the terrain is knowing what's coming in the future. So when I was doing our sci-fi terrain over the last sort of 2, 3, and 4 years, it's got a lot of things in it that already support core space. So all the cargo crates that we did in our 3D terrain before were already the size of core that were needed for the components for core space because I was designing core space at the same time. So I'm kind of like, well, let's just make sure this is all compatible. Core space, like I say, comes with the 3D terrain in the box, but you can say, right, I want to be a more shiny galactic set area. You can pick up our multi-level galactic set, or you can say, right, I want to be gangers and dirty outlands kind of thing. You can go and pick out our like outland set and so on and so forth. Obviously, we've just done a fantasy terrain Kickstarter reasonably recently. And within that, I've made sure that the components, the little chests and so on, are compatible with what we're planning next, which is a fantasy version of core space, so that we've got this core physics, you know, mechanic that we've got as usual. And I'm really looking forward because we've already got the terrain support it, and you know, we're kind of looking at this more of a dungeon type thing. One of the most requested sets we had was the dungeon terrain that we do, which we've discontinued now because obviously we're going to replace it with something a little special. And so really looking forward to kind of getting into that kind of fantasy vibe, and I'm enjoying sort of putting the concepts and the characters together, and taking that physical rule book, that mechanic of that, and popping it in the fantasy, and then giving it my version of the fantasy twist, you know,
right.
Something a little bit different. But interestingly, based in the same universe as Core Space, or should I say based in the same galaxy as Core Space. So it really, it's kind of happening, you know, it's kind of like almost like another expansion of Core Space, but of course, it's
sure.
Not, you
sure.
Know? So I think if you, you know, when it comes time to the, you know, to launch the fantasy, if people have not seen Core Space before or anything like that, they wouldn't really know that it's related, but anyone that owns Core Space will probably see the odd Easter egg and go, wait a minute. I recognize that, you know.
That looks familiar.
And of course, we've got this huge story that we're telling with Core Space, which is a slowly unfolding thing, you know, to do with, I haven't really touched on it, but to do, you know, the main threat of the galaxy, the Purge, and where they come from. And, you know, and everybody's like, well, I wonder if this is related to this and this and that. It's like, well, you've got to wait for the story to unfold. You know, we've got this big story, and Core Space is all about location. So really interested to kind of go to this fantasy particular place of the galaxy where it's not all futuristic, and develop out that world and maybe see an overriding story that kind of brings all things together. That'll be really, really cool. So I'm kind of excited about that. You know, it's a long, like I said, we've got a 5-year plan. So, and I really want to play these games myself, you know, so they're going to happen regardless.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Well, Colin, I can't thank you enough for taking the time, my friend. It was really enjoyable to learn kind of, you know, your process, your approach, and kind of the hell of a journey that you've gone through.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one, but I'm not going to complain. Life is definitely a journey. So it's had its ups and downs, and it's been, you know, it's not easy. It's the work involved is immense. It's not something that just falls easily, as it were. But if it wasn't something I was passionate about, I wouldn't have done it.
Well, I mean, the work's the work, right? Being passionate about it makes it easier, but it doesn't make it less work.
No. I just enjoy what I'm doing, so I can do it for many, many, many more hours than I could if it was anything else. So, I appreciate talking about it. And thanks very much for inviting me over.
It was great, Colin. And for those of you that stuck around to the end to listen, I appreciate it. Take care. Hey, did you hear that? You leveled up. You finished another episode of Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars. If you want more from the Third Floor, follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Head on over to our YouTube channel. It is packed with painting tutorials, gaming tips, battle reports, and role-playing actual plays. Did you enjoy this episode? Why don't you send a link to one of your friends so they can enjoy it too? Last but not least, write us a review on your podcatcher of choice. This helps us find listeners almost as cool as you.
Yeah, waffled a bit there. Sorry about that.
It was phenomenal. Okay, phenomenal, cool. My friend. Yeah, I'll jump in. I'll jump in and shut you up if I need to. Don't worry.
Excellent.
All right. All right. I know how to bring us back. So we went completely off script, my friend, and it was awesome.
Is that all right? Was it? Yeah. I've got the script in front of me. Yeah.
Yep. We completely broke off from it and we killed a break but it was this is the type of conversation I like though, Colin. So I appreciate it. It's just, let's talk about it. Let's see where we go. So
what I was thinking, where you want to go. That's fine.
Beautiful. So when we get back, what I want to talk about is the reality of running a company in the industry and what that's like, particularly what it was like as you transitioned from this is something I do on the side to now it's how I support me and my family. And then I would like to talk about the Kickstarter process, if that's okay.
Sure, definitely.
Great. And then we'll jump into Core Space, which is what I'm real excited.
Yeah, no worries.
Beautiful. All right, I'll bring us back. Hey, are you still here? Look, the podcast is over. And you sat through all of the breaks and bloopers? Well, I mean, if you're here, you might as well run over to patreon.com and become a supporter. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast too while you're at it, on whatever platform you're listening to. I do appreciate you sticking around. Take care.